Double checking, the light is out. Dad's right, the light is out. So I think I can still see enough to get through this. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone, and of course, happy Sabbath. We enjoyed a very rich Thanksgiving with many of our family who came over and enjoyed it at our house, along with our grandchildren. Micah and Gray are truly terrifying to have together at the same time. They're 4 and 3, and the noise is unbearable sometimes. It's amazing. So you love to have them around, dearly love to have them around, just not so much maybe at exactly the same time, if you've experienced that or not, but Ellis is a dream because he's just a year and really everything is fun to him. So but the other two boys, wow, they can make things exciting. So the message I wanted to bring today, what I had been thinking about, it was work-related, because this time of year, some of us, I don't know about how things go for you, but at this time of year, there's a lot of us who have to look forward to an end-of-the-year review with our boss. How many people here have ever been through one of those? How many people here look forward to those? Not normally something that we think in our head, I really want to look for. I just cannot wait. I have a year-end review coming. I was thinking about that because I was thinking, why is it that we don't necessarily look forward to that? I mean, we're trying our very best throughout the year, right? So what we want to have happen is we want to come before our boss, sit down across the table from him, and have him tell us directly to our face in all the ways we've disappointed him and all the ways we just haven't measured up, right? That's part of the fear, I think. That's certainly part of the fear. Got me to thinking about what is it that it takes for us to have a good evaluation. So, and I don't mean just a good evaluation with a boss, but I mean, you know, ultimately we're being evaluated as Christians every single day. What's it take for us to have good evaluations? Years ago, I was offered the opportunity. I want to kind of approach this way. Years ago, I was offered the opportunity to advance in my career. By advance, what that meant was I had an opportunity to be promoted into a manager's position and move to Anchorage, Alaska. We'd never been out of the Pacific Northwest, so this was clearly an opportunity, and I thought a necessary stepping block in my career. And so I took advantage of that opportunity. And I remember shortly, within just a few months, my boss, who had been working the Vancouver branch, who I had been previously working under, he got promoted to vice president of operations. And so here I am thinking, finally don't have to work under him. And then within just like 3 months, I had to work under him again. That's probably a whole other set of lessons there. But I had to come back because, oddly enough, at the time, I had turned over one of my accounts. It was one of my biggest accounts to Fred Reeves, who worked at the same company. And we were in the middle of a fairly large order with that customer. And he asked me to come down and help work our way through that with this client. So I came back down, and then Fred and I did some work with that client while I was here. While I was in town, I was upstairs using my former boss's office. Now, we had an employee who I'd worked side by side with for years, and he had been at the company longer than I had. And every time an opportunity had come along for this individual where he thought he might be promoted, he wasn't promoted. So he was an inside sales associate. The first outside sales job that came along was given to me, this kid who hadn't been working there as long as he had been working there. So how come I got that job? And the next one that came along wasn't given to him. It was given to Rob. And the next one that came along wasn't given to him. It was given to someone else. And then this opportunity to go to Alaska and become a branch manager, well, he didn't even get an interview for that job. Nobody even called him. And then when the opportunity to fill a hole in the Vancouver branch with the next branch manager at that facility, he didn't get interviewed for that job either. So I was sitting there in this my old boss's desk, and I was doing some work. And he came in, and he shut the door, and he wanted to ask me a question. He said, why have I been passed over for all of these opportunities? Why haven't I even been interviewed for them? He says, you know, I've worked here longer than anybody. All these people that have been promoted, I've worked here longer than they have. And he wanted to know why it was that he didn't get these opportunities for advancement that he watched all these other people around him getting. See, he always had satisfactory performance reviews. What's a satisfactory performance review? Well, in those days, a performance review was this. The boss gave you a litany of things. You evaluated yourself on those things, and you decided whether you were below performance, adequate performance, or above performance, generally speaking. And then he did that, and then you did that, and then you compared notes. This was as comprehensive as it got with Gary on those sorts of things, if you remember, Fred. And this individual always got satisfactory performances, just satisfactory right down the line, which means what? Not doing terrible, not doing great, but not doing terrible. You're not really making any big mistakes. But in some ways, I guess you could say not really standing out either. One of the things that it dawned on me was before he came to work with us, he had come out of a union in Portland. Not criticizing unions, but I am pointing out that he had an attitude that he brought with him. The attitude was an expectation that if I work hard, I should be rewarded. If I do a good job every day, I should be rewarded with opportunities. I should be automatically promoted. Now, that may happen in certain circumstances, but in a free will society, a free will work environment in which the boss, the company is privately held, there's no guarantees. So what are they looking for? They're looking for the best and the brightest. They're advancing those people that are working the hardest on themselves. So he said, well, what's different about me than these other people? And I said, I can't say what's different about you, but I can tell you what makes them stand out. Every single one of them was working on personal growth. At some level or another in their life, they were working on themselves. They were trying to become the best they could be. They were pursuing advancement opportunities. They weren't waiting for those things to happen to them. He was a good employee, there's no question about that, but he had an expectation I thought was unrealistic. It was an unrealistic expectation. We have been called to grow, not get satisfactory marks. We need to be growing. This is the thought that is the genesis of this message today. We need to be growing. And I just want to touch on something. This is nothing new. I'm not going to introduce a new idea today. But over in 1 Peter chapter 2, 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 1, therefore, laying aside all malice, all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, all evil speaking, as newborn babies, desire the pure milk of the word. Why? That you may grow thereby. As newborn babies. So I can relate to this more so now almost than ever, as you probably haven't seen our grandson, baby Ellis. That kid is a large baby. He has not missed a single meal his entire life. And he's probably dipping in on the side a little too. So his mother's, she's sitting on the couch next to me and she's nursing him. And I'll tell you, that baby, when it's time to feed, knocking things out of the way and tearing things out of the way, and he's getting to the milk. And he's unhappy until this full process takes place. He is going to be satisfied on mama's milk. So I relate to this desire that he had, and you can kind of mentally extrapolate and say, do I have that desire for the Word of God and for growing, for learning? Do I have that kind of hunger within me? He continues this thought, Peter does, over in 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter chapter 3, and we'll pick that up in verse 17, where he simply says, you therefore, beloved, since you know this beforehand, beware lest you also fall from your own steadfastness, being led away with the error of the wicked, but grow in grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. To him be the glory, both now and forever. Amen. Grow in grace and knowledge. We've been called to grow. I know we know that. Who here doesn't think we need to do that? We're supposed to grow. But what does that mean, to grow? In what way am I supposed to grow? After Thanksgiving, I can look in the mirror and see growth, not the kind of growth I'm talking about. Right? We need to be growing. We can think of overcoming. Let's think of growth as a process that we go through. It leads to a result. Christ told us many times how important it was, the specific result, though, he was looking for. And I think if he says it this many times in a row, we should probably go back and review it just to make sure we understand what he's saying. So I'm going to begin over here in Revelation chapter 2. And these are going to be familiar scriptures to you, I believe. Revelation chapter 2. And I'm just going to hit on a number of these where he says essentially the same thing. In verse 7, he simply says, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give to eat from the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. Verse 11, same chapter, chapter 2 and verse 11. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. He who overcomes shall not be hurt by the second death. Verse 17, same chapter. Verse 17, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna to eat, and I will give him a white stone, and on that stone a new name written, which no one knows except him who receives it. Verse 26, same chapter, chapter 2 and verse 26. And he who overcomes and keeps my words until the end, to him I will give power over the nations. Revelation 3 and verse 5. Revelation 3 and verse 5. He who overcomes shall be clothed in white garments, and I will not blot out his name from the book of life, but I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. Revelation 3 and verse 12. Verse 12. He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I will write on him my new name. Revelation 3, 21, last one in this set. Revelation 3, verse 21. To him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. Overcoming is the end result of the growth process. That's what we're supposed to be doing. Overcoming repeatedly, over and over and over again, the blessing is promised to the overcomer, the person who overcomes, the person who changes, the person who grows. Today I'd like to walk through on this idea of keys to personal growth. Personal growth, because that's what we're called to, is to grow. So I want to give you, I'm going to try to get through five keys to personal growth. I think I've got time now. Five keys to personal growth. These are not unique in all the world of the possible keys to personal growth. I've developed these based on my personal experience. You no doubt have experiences that would lead you to possibly create even a different list of keys for personal growth for yourself. So I'm not here to offer a finite list of the only possible keys to personal growth. These are just ones I'm personally experienced with and have experienced the blessings that have come by recognizing these keys. So I wanted to give you that caveat. Key number one that I'll give you today, and again, these are not in a priority order. They are simply the order in which they occurred to me as I was preparing the message, and that happens to us sometimes. So it's not a hierarchical order, it's just an order. So I'll begin with this one. Embrace change. Embrace change. I begin with this one because I think this was the one that was the genesis of this message to begin with, because a friend of mine no longer works where he worked because he could not embrace change. This is a very fundamental aspect and reality of our life. Change is going to happen. We are all faced with change every day. I say embrace change because from the time we're born until the time we die, we will always be facing change. There isn't a circumstance we're going to wake up at one day where change isn't going to be a part of our world. I was thinking about this last week a little bit before I get into this example of the kind of change that we seem readily, some people seem really capable of, and that's technology. Now, you know on technology how easy it seems like babies and small children get it, right? We can hand our grandchildren an iPad or a cell phone, and they can get around there faster than we can, right? That last week, Mrs. Dick was standing behind Beck and I, Mr. and Mrs. Dick, and they were holding up an iPad, had it on its side. They were singing the hymns from that. She has her Bible on that. She's completely functioning with just that. She does her email on that. She FaceTimes with her grandchildren on that. Everything on this. This didn't even exist several years ago. But this is, so technology's zooming right by, right? And some of us can adapt very quickly to that. Now, some of us don't necessarily adapt very quickly to that kind of change, right? Some people still use an old analog phone because they don't want to be messing around with a phone that's not just a phone, right? I don't need a computer here. I need a telephone. Okay. Other people still have beta computer or beta video players. Probably not. That's probably extreme. But my kids still use VHSs. Both my kids and grandkids are watching still the old VHS Disney movies because we had about 1,000 of them. So we handed that pile down to our kids. They went to Goodwill. They got the old VHS players, and they're still working. So I ask them all the time, though. You've heard of, you know, DVDs, right? That's the new thing. Or Blu-ray. Yes, but that's not what we, you know, all the movies are in VHS. And they work just fine, is what I'm told. So I get that. But on the subject of not maybe dealing with change so well, we had the company that I work for, we are today over 10 times larger as a company than when I started. The problem was, as watching the company grow over these years, I kept seeing this trend where as the size of the company, in other words, I'll use sales as the barometer here, as sales increased, productivity was decreasing. We were not moving as much product as we could be. So while our sales are growing like this, really we're only capable of keeping up like this at a lower level than the sales are coming in. That's a problem. That means that your ability to produce is not keeping up with the demand. That demand is still there, so where will the demand go? To your competitor. If the demand is there, either you get it or someone else gets it, but the demand must be filled. So we were looking at our problems when it came to why can't we keep up with the demand? We're developing it. We need to keep up with it. Let's start producing. So we hired a guy a few years ago to come in and help us sort of really make sure that our demands were meeting that our supply was meeting the demand. And so fast forward a few years, and really we've seen this problem not get any better. So we decided to do some research and move to a process called lean manufacturing. And so lean manufacturing just basically means, and some I think might be aware of this, but basically it's a concept that says that the product comes in, we fill the orders that we have in-house as the product comes in, and it allows you to treat your supply, it allows you to treat your manufacturing process like a gas pedal and brake. When the orders slow down, you can slow down. When the orders increase, you can put the foot on the gas and you can keep up with it. Supply will keep up with the demand. But it takes a process. We have to literally change the way we manufacture our products from A to Z, completely rehaul every aspect of our facility to make sure that everybody has a process in place that's doing lean manufacturing. So that's as far as I need to go with it, because all you need to know really is that it's a change. It's a big change for a manufacturing plant. It's not a little change, it's a big change. So the person that was responsible for this said, I'm on board, I'm going to do this. And we should have been doing this, but if you go 3, 6, 9 months into this process, what we found was sabotaging. I don't believe it was intentional sabotaging. I think it was unintentional sabotaging. The kind of thing that happens when you don't like the change, but you don't want to quit. So you say you'll support the changes, but you really don't like the changes. And so you find yourself doing things that you wouldn't maybe ordinarily be doing. And that's what we were looking at. So this person no longer works for our company. And I knew when I talked to the executive management team that the fundamental reason was an inability to accept and embrace change. But who here hasn't seen that happen in your life, in someone else's life? You just won't accept the fact that there's change. We have to learn to embrace change. Change, the fear of change, by the way, is nothing new. Let's take a different approach to this, a different tack to this. Let's go back to Acts. We've read through this before. I want to read it to you in this context. Acts chapter 6 and verse 8. You can imagine that as the church was being born in and amongst a people that were steeped in tradition, that a change to that tradition may not be the most anticipated thing. Acts chapter 6 and verse 8. And Stephen, full of faith and power, did great wonders and signs among the people. Then there arose some from what is called the synagogue of the freedmen, the Cyrenians, the Alexandrians, and those from Cilicia and Asia, disputing with Stephen. And they were not able to resist the wisdom and the spirit by which he, Stephen, spoke. Then they secretly induced men to say, quote, we have heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and God. And they stirred up the people, the elders and the scribes. And they came upon him, seized him, and brought him to the council. So now he gets to go and sit before the high priest. Verse 13. They also set up false witnesses who said, quote, "This man does not cease to speak blasphemous words against this holy place and the law, for we have heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth will destroy this place and," quote, "change the customs which Moses delivered to us." You're hitting right in the middle of the hot spots and the hot buttons of these people. Change the customs? There ain't going to be no change. There ain't going to be no change. I was just reading through, in the world that we deal with in commercial grease interceptors for restaurants and stuff, that's all, every restaurant's got to have one depending on where you go, right? You can't dump your greasy waste into the waste streams anymore. I'm reading online, I get questioned by somebody in Florida who says, they're saying this and stuff about you guys and I want to know if it's true. So I get to reading it and it reads very much like what I just said to you. It's very much the, we've been doing it this way for so long and it's been working and we ain't going to have no change. It's not new. Let me read to you a letter. I think you're going to appreciate this letter. This letter was from it's a letter that was written to the U.S. President Jackson, at least it's supposedly written to President Jackson, dated January 31, 1829, signed by Martin Van Buren, then governor of New York. So here's this, and the title of this article was Change Feared. "The canal system of this country is being threatened by the spread of a new form of transportation known as railroads. The federal government must preserve the canals for the following reason. One, if canal boats are supplanted by railroads, serious unemployment will result. Captains, cooks, drivers, hostelers, repairmen, and lock tenders will be left without means of livelihood. Not to mention the numerous farmers now employed in growing hay for horses. Two, boat builders would suffer and tow line, whip, and harness makers would be left destitute. Three, canal boats are absolutely essential to the defense of the United States. In the event of expected trouble with England, the Erie Canal would be the only means by which we could ever move the supplies so vital to waging modern war. As you may well know, Mr. President, railroad carriages are pulled at the enormous speed of 15 miles per hour. Engines which, in addition to endangering life and limb of passengers, roar and snort their way through the countryside, setting fire to crops, scaring the livestock, and frightening women and children. The Almighty certainly never intended that people should travel at such breakneck speed." You know, I've traveled to New York in an airplane at 500 miles per hour at 39,000 feet above the ground. So this probably pales a little by comparison. You get the idea that people don't like change. We just don't like change. Yet change is absolutely fundamentally essential for growth. It is impossible to grow without change. It's impossible to grow without change. That doesn't mean that all change is good, that all change is growth. You know, we don't change just for the sake of change. It's simply a reality that change is going to happen in our lives, and we need to learn to embrace that change. Okay? Because there is no growth without change. Key number two. Embrace criticism. Embrace criticism. That's probably all of our favorites, right? Embrace criticism. Personal growth depends upon our willingness to accept criticism. Let's go back here and let's look at. The context of this, of what I'm talking about when I say embrace criticism, is criticism isn't always going to be in the form of constructive. That doesn't make it invalid. Sometimes it just means that somebody like me might be giving it. Maybe it's not the best, okay? Maybe it could be worded differently. Maybe the individual could have phrased it differently. But does that mean that criticism is bad? We need to learn to embrace criticism. It's hard, I know. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 4. You know, God is a loving, merciful, and tender-hearted God. And here we have an example of what when God wants to give you some constructive criticism. It's in the form of correction, but he's trying to steer, just like any parent would do, try to steer this child. So Acts chapter 4 and verse 1, it says, "Now Adam knew Eve his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, and said, 'I have acquired a man from the Lord.' Then she bore again, this time his brother Abel." Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain a tiller of the ground. "And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord." Verse 4, "Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat." This is a clue about the difference, right? One was looking at the very best of his. The other was simply looking at just giving, whatever it is. I don't care. Grab that pile right there, I suppose he might have been thinking. But it says here, "And the Lord respected Abel and his offering," because of the attitude, right? "But he did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell." I mean, you got to wonder, why are you angry? What is going on? Why are you upset? Which is exactly what God wanted to know. So he asked him, "Why are you angry? And why is your countenance fallen?" Now, it's obvious that God knew why, and so he coaches him right here. This is a lot like dad putting his arm around his son and saying, "Come here for a second. Let me tell you something. I need to explain something to you. If you do well, will you not be accepted? Will you not be accepted if you do well? And if you don't do well, sin lies at the door. You know what? Its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. Change your attitude. You can do that." That's literally what he's saying. You can change your attitude. This is constructive criticism. And of course, Cain was very sensitive to this because he immediately went out and killed his brother, right? He had no desire to change his attitude. We're going to get criticism. We have a choice to make. Cain had a choice to make. He chose not to listen. We have choices to make as well. Hopefully we choose to listen. Over in Hebrews chapter 12, Hebrews chapter 12. I'm going to start here in verse 5. It says, "And you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as sons. My son," quote, "do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him." Chastening here means to correct or cause one to learn. It's simply to correct, cause one to learn something, teach them something. "Nor be discouraged when you are," rebuked means disciplined. Right? So when you're disciplined for this, don't be discouraged. "For whom the Lord loves, he teaches, he coaches, he corrects, and disciplines every son whom he receives or loves. If you endure chastening," correction, "God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten, teach, correct?" Which of us doesn't do that? That's what we're supposed to be doing, right? That seems pretty obvious. But how do we endure criticism? How do we endure criticism? We know it's going to come. So really then it's a matter of our attitude. That's what God was trying to tell Cain. It's a matter of your attitude. How do you receive it? Because it's going to come, and it's not always going to come in happy, pleasing words. Sometimes you're going to get correction and criticism in ways that aren't pleasing. Can you learn from that? Are you able to still learn from that? If we embrace criticism, the answer should be yes, we can learn from that. Let's go over here to Mark chapter 10. Mark chapter 10, in verse 13. Here we have, this is the clue that we've been given by Christ himself about how to accept criticism. Mark chapter 10 and verse 13, he says, "Then they brought little children to him, that he might touch them," excuse me. "But the disciples rebuked those who brought them. But when Jesus saw it, he was greatly displeased and said to them, 'Let the little children come to me and do not forbid them, for of such is the kingdom of God. Assuredly, I say to you, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God as a little child will by no means enter it.'" Okay, so what is it about the attitude of a little child? I look around at my grandchildren, and there are many times when I look at their little stinky attitudes, and I don't think they're so great. So what attitudes is God talking about? Because there's clearly something there that we need to have as our attitude. Is it teachability? In my mind, at least one of the things is teachability. And here's why I'll say that. I have a picture of my son Kevin. When we were first building this house that we're living in now, there were some fixtures in the kitchen, on the kitchen sink, that I didn't like. I wanted to change them out, so I got the replacements. And since I have a third-year apprentice son, I wasn't going to do the work. So naturally, I invited my son to come over and for free of charge do the work for his dad. So he brought Grayer over with him. And so Kevin opens the kitchen cabinet doors underneath the sink, and he crawls himself up into there. And, you know, within about 15 seconds, Grayer was crawling over his legs, and all of a sudden, he's sitting inside the cabinet next to Dad. And he's, 2.5, 3 years old at that point? Yeah, about 3, I think. So he's sitting in there next to his dad. And what's he doing? He is studying every single thing Dad's doing. He wants to help. Can I turn that with you, right? Can I hold this wrench for you, Dad? You need to measure something? Here, let me hold the tape measure. What can I do? And it's this attitude of helping, of teaching. Teach me. Show me. I think that's a beautiful attitude that children do have. You might add to that that they receive correction pretty well. Because I've known, when I watch these young men, when they get out of line, all it takes is a little bit of correction, and they are right back in line. But more than that, their attitude is one of love and appreciate you again, and they're sweet, and they're kind, and they're loving. So they're teachable, and I think that they adapt to correction very quickly. It's not that they're seeking correction. They're just doing their thing, and they don't know sometimes when they get out of line. The point is, same thing happens to me with little Micah. If I grab a hammer, and Micah's with us, wherever Papa's going with any tool in hand, Micah's going with said, and if there's any other tool around that, even if I don't need them, he'll be gathering up 2 or 3 himself to follow because he's going to be helping. So he helps me whatever I'm doing. He's usually the one in charge of the tape measure, and this is usually sacred ground for him. So I get that. So I'll tell him, well, we're going to measure from here to here, read Papa the number, and he'll read me the number, and then he'll extend it out, and it comes back in. And I've gone through 2 or 3 tape measures now because the end snaps off at some point the way he does it. It's just a tape measure. So I think about that when I think about small children and what Christ was talking about. Are we teachable? Do we accept correction? One of the best literal examples I had of this was when I was working for a company up in Seattle called Mechanical Solutions, and my boss owned the company, and his brother worked for him, and they were partners, and I was a salesperson. And they had this line that one of the lines we represented, the president of this company had been the former national sales manager for Xerox. I mean, the Xerox company. And it was during the day when Xerox was sold business to business by professional salespeople, and they had the Xerox sales formula. And so when Xerox says this is how you do it, because as successful as they were as a company selling, you did it their way. As all employees went through the training program. Well, this former national sales manager, now president of the company that we represented, a part of his teaching would be to train on sales to any of his rep organizations. And so one day, we were told by my boss, Lee, you guys need to come up here because the president's coming in and we're going to do some training. So during this training, I don't know if you've ever done role-playing. How many people have actually done what we call role-playing? A few people have. So for those who don't know what it is, it literally means, in this particular case, the president says, okay, Lee and Ken, I want you two to role-play. Lee, you're going to be selling to Ken. Ken, you're going to be an engineer. And so I'll clarify further, well, what kind of an engineer? Am I working for a plant? Am I working for an engineering firm? You get your role all defined. And then you're going to play as though you would be that person. And then this salesperson is supposed to give you their best shot. And then after you're done, you're both going to sit down and be evaluated. Now, I won't be evaluated as the role-playing the customer, because the customer's always right. You can't go wrong in that job. But the salesperson ain't always right. So they get an opportunity to be corrected. So I remember very, very much how after Lee and I got done with our role playing, and it's a little awkward, you're in a room of 10 or 12 guys, and, you know, you're pretending, you're play acting. And, you know, while that's normally really fun when you're 6, it gets awkward when you're an adult. So we're doing this thing. We sit down, and this is what surprised me about how Lee handled his end, because he was up for correction. He's the president of the company that I worked for. He's a year older than I am, and he has an opportunity to demonstrate a willingness to be corrected or a resistance to correction. So this is what Lee did. He sat down, he grabbed his notebook, put it in front of him, grabbed his pen, and he leaned forward in his chair and he looked the president of this company directly in the eye. So the president of this company, former Xerox national sales manager, looked him in the eye and he said, okay, here's the correction. Here's the things that you did well. These are the things I think you needed to improve on. And what Mr. Cook did, Lee did, is he just took notes. Okay, all right, all right. And then I've got a question about that. Asked a couple of questions. Now, if I had done it like this, would that have been... Or, oh, you're saying I shouldn't go in this direction here. Okay, gotcha. And you're saying it's because of this. Okay, I understand that. This attitude that Lee brought to that was completely disarming to the entire room. A room waiting for the first team up. The first guy who's going to get nailed, right? Yeah, drill him. Go get him. And he's acting like this is good stuff. I'm really learning something here. And I thought, I've never forgotten that lesson about being teachable, about willing to accept criticism. It's very, very difficult. Our young club members have opportunities to practice this all the time. It's particularly challenging as an evaluator to not wound these little minds by ripping them to shreds. You need to give them some criticism, but you don't really want to do it as criticism. You really want to give them constructive criticism, right? But this is the same kind of an opportunity for them to learn, to sit there. And it's those who are teachable who learn the quickest, right? Who have that attitude of teach me. I know I'm not perfect, but here are three quick lessons I learned from that. You have to accept that you're not perfect. Accepting that you're not perfect will allow you to learn from your mistakes. So a key, in other words, to accepting criticism is to just accept the fact that you're not perfect. None of us are perfect. We're going to make mistakes. If you know that, you're going to be more open-minded. So be open-minded to the fact that others may see things about you that you don't see about yourself. All of us have a blind spot back here, don't we? I do. Some of ours are bigger, some of them are smaller, but all of us have them. And it's those blind spots that you're really going to get information about normally if you're going to accept criticism. So we have to be willing and open-minded to somebody else who may see something in us we don't see. Allow them to know that and then allow them to share that with us. When in doubt, seek clarity by taking notes and asking questions. So seek clarity. Take notes, ask questions. So if you're going to be in an interview situation with your boss, that's a great technique to go into that with. It will show that you are a teachable person with a willing mind, an open mind to receive criticism. We have to be able to receive criticism in order to grow. Key number three. Embrace your strengths and weaknesses. It's essential, I think. That's why I can't call a priority to any of this, because each of these are important, and they're important in different ways. We all have strengths and weaknesses. If you find yourself working in an area that forces you to deal in your weaknesses, you're not setting yourself up for success, are you? So I'll share a personal story. It's not meant to be derogatory toward me, so don't take it that way. I literally am in a new job, the job I've had for the last 2.5 or 3 years now, because I was in a job that I was terrible at. And the reason is because it had me living in a weakness, an area that was a weakness for me. I'm not somebody that should be managing lots and lots of other people doing things the way they want to do them when I want them to do it the way I want it done. Which is a problem, apparently. So if I'm out there correcting somebody who's doing a good job the way they want to do it, but it ain't my way, I really should just shut up. And so after doing that for 2 years, I was stressed the whole time. For me, that's just stress. I don't like doing it. I want to help people be successful, but I don't want to tell them, you're fired if you don't do it my way. I don't want to have that kind of power over their life. I want to just help them succeed. So we literally had to step back. More comprehensive than a survey. I don't know what that would be, but like an assessment. So we took some assessments and found out that, you know, if you were to take the assessment and then put it on a chart that says, here he should be, if he's scoring well, he should be in the job he's in, and I was here. So he's not anywhere near, you know, a job he should be in. That's what it came up and said. Okay, what did I learn? I learned that I was in a job that exploited my weaknesses but not my strengths. So I'm now in a job I wrote for myself that exploits my strengths and avoids my weaknesses. Now, I'm happy, the company's happy, and probably everybody who used to work for me is very happy. So, again, just to highlight that we need to be learning and growing and changing, but understanding that we have strengths and we have weaknesses. We want to build on our strengths. We want to overcome our weaknesses. 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Let's go here. You know, as we've got the next several months before we get to Passover, right? But examining ourselves, which we're told to do, we're just going to remind ourselves of that instruction. Is that supposed to be the week before Passover? Hang tough. You don't have to worry about it. Passover is nowhere near. 1 Corinthians 11. A couple of things that are interesting about this to me. 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 28. Let's pick it up here. But let a man examine himself. Well, what word is that, examine? Well, that word means to test, examine, prove, scrutinize, to see whether a thing is genuine or not. Okay, so in this sort of a thing, it means to just evaluate evidence. That's really all it means, evaluate the evidence. So if you were looking at a diamond, you might do a cursory examination, which would be to look at it, and if you're able to do this, anybody here know how to actually look through the lens thing to see the imperfection inside of a diamond? I've never been able to see the imperfection. I don't know what it takes. It's a real skill, apparently, because I cannot do it. But they look through this thing, and they're staring in there. Oh, yeah, that's got an occlusion here at the that. And you're like, what is an occlusion again? And I'm looking in here. Oh, yeah, yeah. At some point, I just go, okay, yeah, I got it. I have no idea. What is the point? That's a cursory examination. Cubic zirconia can look exactly like a diamond. And if you do a cursory examination like that, you might not know the difference. But an examination is to consider the evidence. So that's what he's talking about here first. Now let's build on that. Go over to 2 Corinthians 13:5. Now we have similar English words being used, but they're different Greek words, you'll understand in a second here. Examine yourselves. That's a different word, examine. Examine yourselves as to whether you are in the faith. That word examine, let me read you from Vincent's Word Studies. It says, instead of putting Christ to the test, test yourself. This word is better used as try. Try is better than examine. Try in the sense of a trial, to try, like a trial. What happens in a trial? A prosecutor is going to present a thorough case. He's going to examine not only a witness, but he's going to bring forth testimony. He's going to thoroughly vet and present a package of evidences to be considered. So here is what he's saying. So I want you to put yourself on trial as to whether you are in the faith. And then he says, test. Now that word test is the same from 1 Corinthians 11:28, which is to do what? To examine, to prove, or to scrutinize, as in to see whether a thing is genuine or not. This is examine the evidence. So in the first case is put yourself through the process of a trial in which you discover all of the evidence and then examine the evidence. For what? Do you not know yourselves that Jesus Christ is in you? This is the question. Unless indeed you are disqualified, test yourselves to answer that question. Try yourselves. Put yourself on trial and evaluate yourself to ensure that you know whether or not you are called of Christ. That's what he's saying. That level of examination then is like putting yourself on trial. You know, you're calling witnesses, you're looking at things, you're examining things, you're looking for the truth about yourself. Well, what happens if we don't like the truth? Too bad. That's not the point. The point is you're trying to discover your strengths and weaknesses. And you can't do that if you're not willing to shed the veil and look honestly at yourself. I have strengths, but I have weaknesses. What are those? I need to know what those are. Galatians 6 and verse 4 sort of wraps up this same thought. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 4, where he says, but let each one examine his own work, and then he will have rejoicing in himself and not in another. What it's simply saying is examine yourself against yourself. What good is it if we examine ourselves against someone else? I can always find someone else in a particular area that's doing worse than me. That is not a help, right? That is not identifying my current strengths and weaknesses. I can maybe identify theirs in that way, but that isn't helping me at all. So this examination is all about me examining me against me, not comparing myself to anyone else. which, by the way, has always been a challenge because I've always been somebody that competed with other people. I've had to learn that this isn't a competition against other people. Not a competition against anybody but myself. Personal growth requires us to build on our strengths and overcome our weaknesses. Now, you can go online to identify strengths and weaknesses by doing, what would we call those things, analyses or assessments or things like that, right? We can do those things for ourselves. But, you know, there's some visible things you can do if you just step back from your life and look at it. Just step back and look at yourself, and you can begin to identify some strengths and weaknesses right away. For example, what do you spend your time on? Now, some people spend, okay, two areas here we're talking about. At work, if you have a job outside the home, even sometimes inside the home, because there are many workers who work in the home and not outside, but if you have a job and you find that you have a choice between project or workload A or project or workload B, which one do you like better? Which one do you find yourself working on maybe more often than others? It doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter to me what it is, but it can help you to identify an area that's a possible strength for you because we tend to do more often the things we like to do, right? So what do you find yourself spending time on? If you have a personal choice in time, what do you spend it doing? Now, I like to say that I like to play golf, but if you watch me golf, you might not call that a strength. So I'm not saying that it all equals the same. But what do you like to spend your time on? Number two, what do people compliment you about? What I'm talking about here is unsolicited compliments. You know the compliment when somebody comes up to you, you're not trolling the room for pats on the back. You're just doing something, and somebody comes up and out of the blue, unsolicited, says some compliment to you. If you can compile those compliments in your mind, is there anything that comes up repeatedly? You get complimented several times in this area. It might be you're a good comforter of other people. And you get thanked for that a lot. And people come up and say, I really appreciate how you were comforting to me in this way. Or you're a great listener. Maybe that's a strength of yours, not a strength of mine. But it might be a strength of yours. I love people who listen. That might make sense to some people. All right. What mistakes have you made more than once? See, if we make mistakes repeatedly, we're probably working in an area. I've made mistakes repeatedly, by the way, in certain areas. And believe me, I look back on them and they're just this giant, big, red, bolded, emphasized, underlined, exclamation pointed things that say weakness. Right there. Don't go there. So if you find that you've made mistakes more than once in a particular area, you might be looking at an area that's a weakness for you. Okay, so something you might need to work on. Or if it's an area that's beyond skills or something like that, it might be something you want to avoid. What do you like to talk about? This is interesting. So when you come home from work or when you get together with family, what do you like to talk about? I don't mean what do they like to talk about. I mean when you want to share something, what does it tend to be about? If it's about your work, what is it about? Oftentimes we like to talk about the things that give us pleasure. And if it's about work, there are things we like to do at work and we'll sometimes share those things. So you can identify an area that's a possible strength for you in the areas you like to talk about. The last one would be, what do friends and families have to say about you? This is one where you do solicit, but it wouldn't probably be in a room like this, right? This is the kind where you're sitting down one-on-one with somebody and you say, hey, maybe over a cup of coffee, listen, I'm looking for some honest feedback here. What, you know, I'm looking to identify some strengths and weaknesses in my life to work on, and I'd like you to help me with that. And a good friend is going to be willing to do that, even if it's uncomfortable, right? And it can be very uncomfortable to tell somebody, I notice that you have this weakness in your life, and if you're willing to work on it, I'm willing to cheer and to pray and to work with you on it. So asking our friends and our family can help us to identify areas in our life that are strengths or weaknesses. Again, we need to be building on our strengths, and we need to be overcoming our weaknesses if we're going to have good personal growth. This particular next lesson or next key I'm calling Embrace Letting Go of the Past. Embrace letting go of the past. This is, I don't know, I'm not going to ask for a raise of hands, but I bet if I ask people to raise their hands, I bet you we'd have a room full of hands saying, yes, this is a tough one. Right? Very difficult to let go of the past. There's really kind of two key concepts that are competing for each other, isn't there? There's sort of the, hey, if you don't remember the past, you're condemned to repeat it. Okay. But that's lesson learning, isn't it? That's what that's about. Learning our lessons of the past. It doesn't mean dwelling there. But I'm not talking about that. We're talking about the kind of letting go that happens when you make a mistake. You commit a sin. You do something wrong that you know you shouldn't have done, and you're living with it. It's not easy to let go of the past, but it's absolutely essential. I'll share a personal story. I remember this like it was yesterday because it was so awful. But it's worth sharing. I think you guys will agree. I was doing a presentation, and the manufacturer we had happened to be the one with the Xerox salesman as the president, by the way. And a competitor had come out with a competing product. And I thought, you know, in a cursory review, boy, I learned some lessons in this, but in a cursory review of the competitor's product, I learned that it looked to me like they were coming out with a shoddy Me Too that wasn't really equal. It was just a shoddy Me Too. And the technology they were using was an adaptive technology that was as of yet unproved in this particular category. But here's the thing that I did wrong. So my boss, one of my bosses, one of the partners, he had created a presentation to specifically go and give to engineers because they were asking us to come in and talk about the differences between your product and your competitor's product. Okay. Set up a lunch and learn with the largest engineering firm in Eugene. So there's 30 guys in this room. The owners, two of the I think there's five partners, and two of the partners were in the room. Here's a lesson for you young guys. I didn't create this presentation, so it was not mine. So I didn't own any of it psychologically, mentally. I didn't own it educationally. I'm taking somebody else's work, and I'm just using it. That's a red flag, by the way. So I'm running through the slides, and we get to this particular slide, and it has some information on it of which I have no idea if we can prove what I'm about to say out loud, but I'm just reading the slide out loud. I read the slide, and an engineer raises his hand, and he calls me out on that point. Have you guys actually tested it to see whether it does what you just said? Well, no, not that I know of. Wow, did he get mad? Called me unprofessional. He stormed out of that room as I was shrinking into a pile of goo. Wow, did I learn a lesson that day. I will tell you, I learned a lesson that day about do your homework. Do not take somebody else's work for granted. But man, I carried that around for a long time. It was a long time before I wanted to go back into that engineering firm, right? And my mom would say, get back up on that horse. You know, that's the old adage, if you get bucked off a horse, get right back up and on. Why? Otherwise, you become afraid to get back up and on. I should have called that firm up within a month and said, I'm back, I've done the research, I'm ready to go. I wasn't back there for a year. A year it took me before I could get over that. I could not let go of that. And I mean, every night, I'm like sweating, remembering, reliving in great detail his screaming at me and my shirking back and all the awfulness that was that situation for a professional salesperson. This is truly agonizing. And so naturally, I wanted to let go, right? Just put that off. No big deal. Took me a year to try to let that go. I don't even think I let that go for a year, but I was at least somewhat past it over after a year later. We have to let go. You can't move forward unless you let go of the past. That's the whole point. I've learned that lesson. That doesn't mean I still don't make that mistake. You know, I'll speak up here, I'll slip one word, and for the next week, you know what will happen to me? Every night, I will be thinking about that. You know, I wish I'd said that differently. And my wife will be like, would you let it go? Because we have a hard time letting go. But you know, it's not just failures. Sometimes we have a hard time letting go of successes too, especially if they're hard to come by. The problem is you can get stuck on a past success the same as you can on a failure. In either case, you're getting stuck. We used to call, well, maybe still do call it, it didn't originally mean this, but resting on your laurels, anybody ever heard that term? Resting on your laurels used to mean something different than it does today. Today it's negative. It means you're lazy. You had one success, whoop-de-doo. It's like the guy who catches a touchdown in a game, they're losing 54-0, and he catches one touchdown, and he's screaming and jumping around in the end zone like, we just won the game. There's a disconnect here, I think. You know, one success doesn't mean the game is over, and it doesn't matter whether you're losing 54 or whether you're leading 54. Not a single success is what we're after here. We have to do this for a lifetime. And so we can't park ourselves on any of our successes any more than we can on any of our failures. We've got to keep moving forward. We've been called to continue to keep moving forward, to continue to grow. That's the whole point. Okay, the last area I want to talk about today, the last key, is embrace contentment. Embrace contentment. I guess we all intellectually understand this, but I wanted to kind of walk through this because, you know, club here, this last meeting, the topics master asked the question of only the mature men in the room, which I considered myself. He didn't ask, so I just raised my hand. So he says, I'm asking all you older guys here to answer this question. And the question was, if you could go back in your life and change something, what would it be? I used to think everything in life is the way that it is because it was where you were at when you were going through it, so I wouldn't go change anything or I would be different. But as I got to really thinking about that over the years, there is something I would like to change because it would have led to a more peaceful life. I would go back and I would learn to be content. It's the number, I think if I go back and look at the failures of my life, it would say it's probably the number one cause of distress was a lack of being content. A lack of contentment, not feeling content. What does that mean? It means to be pleased and satisfied. Let's go over to Philippians 4, verse 11. These aren't going to be new. You've heard these before. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 11. Not that I speak in regard to need, Paul is saying, and he's talking physical needs here. For I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. It's interesting when you go back and consider the issue of contentment doesn't matter whether you are abased or abounding, if you are rich or poor. Contentment applies to both. It may seem to us as though contentment would be more difficult for the poor. Well, if that were the case, Christ wouldn't have been talking about all the challenges that the rich have inheriting the kingdom. Contentment is a problem for both, right? It just may be more tangible, it might seem like, to us. Because if you are struggling to make ends meet, it might seem like, you know, you're more likely to have needs that aren't being met. So how can you possibly be content with your circumstances? It may seem like that. But Paul is talking about personal contentment. Let me go over here to 1 Timothy 6:6. Where this is, Paul brings this up again to his young apprentice, Timothy. Now, godliness with contentment is great gain. And I love this thought. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain that we carry nothing out. And having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. This is not new, by the way. This idea of being content or of lacking this. The idea that we need to be content is where I want to go here. The idea that we need to be content isn't new. Christ himself talked about it. He talked about it in a context that helps us to marry up the idea that it doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor, whether you're content or not. Let's go back and read what Christ said when he was talking in Matthew during the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter 6. We're going to begin here in verse 25 to pick up this idea as expressed by Christ. He says, therefore I say to you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air, for they neither sow nor reap nor gather into the barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them, and are you not more important than they? Which of you by worrying can add one cubit to his stature? So why do you worry about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. Neither do they toil nor spin. And yet I say to you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Why did he say Solomon right there? Solomon was the wealthiest man on the planet during his day. He's being juxtaposed to the people who have nothing, to the people who have everything, and both need to be content. What is it about contentment? I can tell you this lesson. Luke 16:10, we're just about wrapping up here, but Luke 16:10, I want to remind you of something. It has to do with blessings, because we've personally experienced this idea in our lives, so I really feel it's a strong lesson. Luke 16:10, where it simply says, "He that is faithful in which is least is faithful also in much. The same as he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much." This is a principle that we can apply to the idea of contentment. Why? Because if we're not content, you're a bottomless pit into which all God can do is pour blessings and nothing will come out the other end. God will not pour blessings into a bottomless hole. What's the point? If you're content with little, you'll be content with much. We need to be content with wherever we are, with as little as we have or as much as we have. But it's only when we learn contentment that God feels more free to bless us, because he's not going to pour those blessings down a hole that can't be filled. An important lesson on this idea: we can't grow unless we are content. We need to learn to be content with where we are. Focus in on what is truly, truly important to us. Let's finish this up over in 1 Timothy again. I want to wrap up this thought, 1 Timothy 6, verse 9. Again, 1 Timothy 6, picking the same story up we were reading earlier, in verse 9 now, but it says, "But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare." So he's saying, I was content in nothing, but look at the problem with the rich. "Those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness, and pierced themselves through with many sorrows." He's describing the unquenchable. He's describing the pit that can't be filled, the hole that can't be filled. But he says to us rather, "But you, O man of God," verse 11, "flee these things and do what? Pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, gentleness." These are the things that God wants us to be working and adding into our lives. Be content and work on these things. When we really are content in our lives, we can then focus on these things. Once we're content with where we are, we can work on the really important stuff. That's what God's trying to teach us through these lessons. We can, but we need to learn to be content. As I said at the beginning, this is the time of year when those of us who have an annual review, well, we begin kind of mentally preparing for it. We're getting ready for it. We have to be thinking about it. But I thought it's a good time, because we're still several months in advance of Passover, and truly examining yourself. You know how long it takes to go through an actual courtroom trial? Weeks and weeks and weeks, if not months and months and months. Why? Preparing evidence, evaluating evidence takes time. The same is true for our lives. As we're identifying our strengths, our weaknesses, the things we need to be working on, the things we need to be overcoming, it takes time. We've got that time between now and Passover. Let's put something else on that list and let's get it taken care of. We've got the time for it. We need to embrace change. If we're going to grow, personally, professionally, we need to embrace change. We need to embrace criticism. It's not always going to come as corrective, or what's the word? Construct, thank you, Nathan. It doesn't always come as constructive criticism. Sometimes it comes as harsh criticism. But that doesn't mean that there's not a lesson for us to learn from it. We need to be open to, we need to embrace criticism. We need to embrace our strengths and our weaknesses. We need to build on those strengths. We need to overcome our weaknesses. We need to embrace letting go of the past. We can become stuck on past failures. We can become stuck on past successes. We can't become stuck on anything in the past. We need to be moving forward. We need to embrace contentment. We need to learn to be content. Whether we are abounding in blessings or barely making it, God will not let us down. We know that. He wants to bless us, but he's not going to reward the person who cannot be content. So we need to learn to be content. We need to be working on all of these things. These are just five keys today, just five keys that I think will help us all when we think about how we might grow personally and professionally as we go towards Passover.